Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, it's good to see you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm still COVID positive. I'm just announcing it to the world, you know. Is there a stigma to that anymore? Or
I don't think so.
It just kind of happens.
Think so. Yeah. We all have gotten it not once, twice, three times. Who knows at this point?
This is number two for me. This is number two, but it's not pleasant.
It's not pleasant, and it also just fucking lingers. It's hard to get rid of that thing.
I know. I'm not even sick anymore, but I don't want to get any of the Vitor children germs.
I appreciate that. Since, I did give it to my daughter, but the three-month-old, so far, he's doing okay. I will say I missed you and I missed doing the show, but to be honest, all I want to talk about today is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the dead bear carcass story. I don't know
if you
guys
not get a chance
that.
To podcast about that?
I did not, and I was very sad because I've never laughed harder in my life than watching Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s little weird video that he put out himself where he's telling Roseanne Barr about throwing a dead baby bear in his car for some reason.
As a New Yorker, too, like the idea that it was just a normal thing to do after a steak dinner at Pierre Louvre's. I mean, can we spend a minute on this?
Well, let's start at the beginning. Yeah, okay, he was going falconing. Yeah. This is like what precipitates the whole story. He's going falconing and he sees a dead bear cub on the side of the road. So he pulls over to get it.
And here's what I was struck by the logistics too, Tommy, because he gets it. He has all these reasons why, it's kind of litigious reasons why it's okay to like eat bear and keep it chopped up in your fridge as if that's like a normal thing to do. But then he goes to Pierre Louvre's, right? Great steakhouse.
Super fancy, famous, iconic steak place.
Yeah, get the bacon appetizer. It's great. Pierre Louvre's is in Brooklyn, okay? Then he says he has a flight to catch, which is presumably like Kennedy Airport, which is in Queens. But he, on the way to the airport, is going to take a massive detour into Central Park with a bunch of drunk guys. And happens
but
to have
he wasn't drinking.
But he wasn't drinking. Happens to have a bicycle that he's going to get rid of with the bear.
Why
in the
did he have a bike in his car? How big is this car that you have a bike and a dead bear in the car at the same time? What are you talking about, dude?
And then just like staging a... And first of all, you can't drive into Central Park. I don't know when this happened. I mean, because they banned cars in Central Park. So did he get out of the car and walk the bear carcass and the bike into the park? Or what the hell's going on here?
I just put it on the front on the little basket or something?
Yeah, I couldn't possibly have more questions about this. You know, I really couldn't. And then former guest on Crooked Media Podcast, Tatiana Schlossberg, wonderful reporter, John F. Kennedy's granddaughter, wrote the article for the New York Times about the dead bear. That was like the kicker, the thing that just tipped it over the top.
And he's doing the thing that politicians always think they can do when a bad story is coming, which is that you front run it. You try to get the fact out ahead of whoever like did all the hard work to report out this anecdote. So he films a video of himself telling this anecdote to presumably the most batshit crazy person he could find, who was Roseanne Barr. And even her face in the reaction shots is like, what are you talking about, pal? Like, you have lost the thread even for me. It's incredible.
And she just happened to be in his kitchen. Like, that's a weird thing. Is Roseanne Barr, like, in the guest house? Like, Kate O'Kale? Like, what's going on here, you know?
I'm reading Jeffrey Toobin's book about the O.J. Simpson trial right now, which, you know, is many years old, but is incredible. And I'd forgotten all about Kate O'Kale. What a character.
Yeah, one of the better O.J. characters. I'm not going to make since I'm on a version of Zoom, I'm not going to make a Jeffrey Toobin joke, though. We'll let that one pass.
Yeah. Stay there. Anyway, look, glad we got through that because I just, you know, what a story. But back to the show. We're going to talk about a lot of big news. So there's this major military operation by the Ukrainian forces into Russia that's still going on right now. We've got this ongoing concern that Iran and Hezbollah are preparing to retaliate against Israel and launch some major strike. We'll talk about the latest on, you know, the ongoing nightmare that is life in Gaza, an effort to broker a ceasefire. We'll talk about how activists are trying to change course now that Joe Biden is not running for re-election and influence Kamala Harris's policy and, you know, things people are doing at her events to try to put more pressure on the administration to change course on Gaza. And then we're also going to cover the reports that Iran hacked the Trump campaign, the latest from Venezuela a couple weeks after the election, an ISIS plot against Taylor Swift, and the most offensive thing to happen to Pompeii since that song by Bastille. So we got a big show.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Just kidding. I don't dislike Bastille. They're fine. Then, Ben, you did the interview today. What do we got?
Yeah, so this is the third anniversary of the collapse of Kabul. And so I think it was important to kind of circle back to that. And we have Sahar Halamzayan, who's been on this podcast before. She works for the Malala Fund now, which is doing a lot of work to support women and girls in Afghanistan. So we talked about how life has changed, obviously, for the worst, really the horrific conditions, kind of hopelessness that women and girls have in Afghanistan, but also their incredible bravery in continuing to protest for their rights. Malala's taken the lead in advancing the idea of gender apartheid, essentially that the Taliban system of denying women access to really anything in Afghanistan is tantamount to apartheid, and trying to get that codified under international law as a crime against humanity.
That's interesting.
It is an interesting idea. Yeah. So she kind of walks
obviously
us
it's apartheid, right? I mean, clearly, yeah.
There's a common sense to it, you know, that essentially if you're a woman in Afghanistan, it's just like if you were a black person in South Africa, it's a totally separate set of laws. And so it's an innovative way to try to get new tools to hold the Taliban accountable, to ensure that countries, including the U.S., have women included in their engagements with Afghanistan. So it's definitely worth checking out. It's a powerful interview at a, you know, a sad anniversary.
Yeah, absolutely. And Sahar is an incredibly compelling, you know, person, and who's done a lot of great work. So worth checking out. Okay, Ben, so let's start with this big development from Ukraine. So, you know, the top military commander in Ukraine says that his forces now control 386 square miles of Russian territory in the Kursk region of Russia. For our international listeners, that's 1,000 square kilometers. Nice little conversion chart there. So this is an area right on the border between Russia and Ukraine. The Russian governor of the Kursk region says that over 120,000 civilians have had to flee and 60,000 more are waiting to get evacuated. Russians are also being evacuated from the neighboring Belgorod region. So this was a surprise operation launched by Ukraine last week. According to Bloomberg News, it was kept secret from even the rank and file soldiers until the day before. So these guys were just kind of amassing in the woods, not knowing where they're going to go next. The Ukrainian military clearly found an exploited a border crossing that was thinly guarded. They seem to have surprised the Russians, or at least the Russian military was very slow to respond to whatever they saw. I would imagine, Ben, that Putin is furious about this, you know, humiliating operation, but analysts at the Institute of War say the Kremlin seemed to be trying to downplay it to avoid panic or backlash. That said, I've seen some reports that Russians in Moscow have rallied to support people who were evacuated from Kursk. So, you know, there is a scenario where Putin could use this to his advantage and, you know, rally more broad support for the war. But, you know, time will tell. In a televised meeting with security officials, Putin said, quote, "The West is fighting us with the hands of Ukrainians." He also said, unironically, quote, "But what negotiations can there be with people who indiscriminately attack civilians and civilian infrastructure or try to threaten nuclear energy facilities?" The White House National Security spokesman John Kirby was asked about this operation during a press briefing. Here's a clip.
"The only people at war in Ukraine are the Russians. They're the ones that invaded Ukraine. And Ukraine is defending itself against that aggression. This is Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine, pure and simple, always has been since the beginning. I'm not going to talk about Ukrainian military operations, as I said earlier. I'll let them speak to what they're doing. We're in close touch with them, as you might expect we would be, and that will continue, those conversations. But make no mistake about it. This is Putin's war against Russia. And if he doesn't like it, if it's making him a little uncomfortable, then there's an easy solution. He can just get the hell out of Ukraine and call it a day. Leave it at that."
Little NSC shade there from Kirby. Yeah, yeah. So, Ben, look, we just, everyone should know, like, we don't have a ton of information about what's happening in Russia right now. The most experienced analysts don't either. Like, things are moving quickly. No one besides a small circle of Ukrainian officials probably seem to know what Ukraine is going to do next, if they're going to try to expand the territory they've taken, if they'll retreat. We don't know. But I'm 100% confident that what will happen now is this operation will become a key part of the argument you've been hearing from Ukrainian officials for a very long time, which is that Biden needs to take the shackles off and let Ukraine hit targets in Russia with U.S. weapons. Do you think that this operation makes that argument more compelling?
Yeah, I think there are a few things going on here, and it's the Ukrainians trying to kind of create a new normal for their military operations and for the weapons that they're using. First of all, we've talked about a lot over the last year that Ukraine is kind of not losing, but, you know, incrementally losing ground on the front line, Russia just has more people, more artillery, more small arms to kind of throw at the front line in eastern Ukraine. Russia had actually been making some gains in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. Morale was down in Ukraine. They're stretched thin. And so I think they're doing a few things here. We've talked about how already we'd seen them, you know, take some shots into Russia, take some shots into Crimea, take some shots at the Russian fleet in the Black Sea. That's where they can go on offense. You know, we learned in their counteroffensive last year that they don't really have the sufficient manpower and weaponry to kind of break through the Russian front lines that are kind of fortified and almost like trench warfare style. Where they can make some gains is if they do something that's a surprise and that strikes the Russians where they're not expecting it. That's the first thing that's happening. I think the other thing that's happening is the Ukrainians were getting very frustrated about the fact that because they couldn't strike into Russia, essentially the Russians, you know, treated the Ukrainians like sitting ducks. They had all this stuff across the border. They were firing at the Ukrainians. Well, this is obviously pushing the front line back well into Russia.
Big time.
The other thing is, I think there's a lot of talk about getting into a negotiation. And even the Ukrainians themselves appear to be more open to negotiating with the Russians, with the kind of understanding that they're probably not going to reclaim all their territory. Well, you might want to go into that negotiation with a big chunk of Russian territory as well. That depends on holding it, though. And so the capacity of the Ukrainians to actually hold on to a piece of Russia is something that we just don't know yet. I will say that this is not a small deal. Like, Russia has not been invaded since World War II, okay? Mm-hmm. That's a long time. Putin's whole rationale for this war is about making its borders more secure. And so this is the Ukrainians sending a message that actually the Russian borders are less secure. It's a blow to the prestige of the Russian state that's supposed to be able to protect the Russian people in exchange for all the horrible autocracy that they have to put up with, right? So it's a big roll of the dice, a big gamble. We still don't quite know how it's going to play out. But I mean, look, Tommy, if like Mexico, you know, invaded Texas and took a huge, you know, several hundred mile piece of territory, that would be something. You can't just kind of say, yeah, Oh, it's no big deal, you know?
Yeah, I think your spin cycle is done. Yeah, no, that would be a very big deal. To your point about whether Ukraine will hold this territory, I mean, the hard part would be resupplying these troops who are miles and miles into Russia. Now, I mean, look, it's a big deal to move tens of miles into Russia. Russia is also 5,600 miles wide. So, you know, you got a long way to go before you're really threatening Putin. But, you know, it's very impressive. Also, this just kind of got me reading, Ben, because I don't know that we've talked sort of big picture about the war in a while, or at least sort of this manpower question. Bloomberg News had a great report on comparing the manpower at this point of both armies. So Ukraine has about 900,000 troops, while Russia has 1.15 million, but are trying to ramp up to 1.5 million. But Bloomberg reported that their recruitment efforts are really struggling at this point. I guess in Moscow, you can get financial bonuses if you're a new recruit that basically nets out to you making three times the average salary in Moscow last year. So they're just like throwing money at people who will sign up for this war, but they're still not hitting these quotas. So there's a question about whether there might be another draft. And, you know, what the reason that's necessary, obviously, is this war could go on for the long term, but also the Russians have sustained up to 500,000 casualties. And the last 3 months have been the worst period of Russian casualties in the entire war. I think there's as high as 1,200 per day happening. So it was just sort of an interesting snapshot into the broader state of the war, but also why these surprise operations are so important, because if the Russians decide they really need to repel these Ukrainian forces quickly, they're going to have to pull a bunch of troops off the lines from other parts of the front, and that could change the calculus in other areas. So it's just this like ongoing chess game that's happening.
Yeah, it, you know, the whole thing is makes you think about what position is Russia in. You know, it seemed like they had this kind of slight upper hand, but as is often the case with Putin, there can be like some premature triumphalism. So there's a couple ways of looking at it, one that is kind of negative for Russia and one that is more advantageous to Russia. Like on the negative side, look, we had Prigozhin like marching on Moscow, remember, about a year ago?
Mm-hmm.
This is the second time in the last, you know, 3 years that basically an invading army has moved into Russian territory and taken it. That there's just no good way to spin that. You combine that with the kind of desperation for manpower, it's not as if Putin is kind of growing 10, 15, 20 feet tall through this war. This war is bad for him. It's bad for Russia, right? And this is clearly not what he wants. The video people should check out of Putin hosting a National Security Council meeting where he's getting briefed on this is so good because he just looks like he's seething sitting there getting these reports.
And you see the one where the governor of the Kursk region governor was like, he's, you know, just talking about how much territory has been taken over by these Ukrainian forces. And he's like, leave those numbers to the military. Just shuts this guy down. For stating facts.
It's just like, hey, local official, you know,
shut the fuck up.
On the other hand, you know, Russia's big. They do have manpower. They do have weapons. Invasions of Russia traditionally have not ended well. You know, you can ask the Germans and the French about that. And so, you know, you can't get triumphalist on the Ukrainian side. I think what it highlights is that this war is just bad for everybody. And it's obviously Putin's fault. He's the guy who initiated it. But I think the Ukrainians, you know, it just shows that we're entering a phase where between now and wherever negotiation happens, and we're going to have to wait till our election to figure out how that begins, because, you know, everybody's waiting to see if it's Trump or Harris. The Ukrainians, you know, they just also got their first delivery of F-16s. They've made their first big play into Russia. You could just start to see, to your original question, them pushing the boundaries, you know, of this escalation risk. And, you know, the Americans have been concerned, the Biden administration has been concerned about, you know, what could tip into an escalation that causes Russia to lash out, or God forbid, you know, Putin threatens to use nuclear weapons. I just think we're going to be living with a fairly precarious escalation risk. I will say, though, you know, the Ukrainians invaded Russia and Putin's not really doing much different in response.
Right.
I mean, they keep kind of proving that they can push a little further. Now, the question is, how far can they push before, you know, Putin decides to do something that is more catastrophic than what he's already done? And nobody knows that except Putin.
Yeah. So far, the response seems to be being bombing random villages. So, yeah. Typical.
Yeah, it's his go-to.
Speaking of wars that are bad for everybody, let's turn to Israel and Iran. So Israel and U.S. intelligence agencies are reportedly convinced that Iran is making military preparations for a large-scale attack on Israel in retaliation for Israel's assassination of a Hamas leader named Ismail Haniyeh on Iranian soil. Ben, I did not get to listen to last week's episode because I spent almost literally every waking moment working or parenting on my vacation, so that was stupid of me. But every time I read about one of these, like, daring Mossad operations deep into some enemy territory, I think to myself, why don't you guys just do that and systematically take out Hamas's leadership that way rather than continue this catastrophic war in Gaza?
You mean you don't need to drop 5,000-pound bombs to kill like a single Hamas operative in Gaza? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I'm saying it seems like the Mossad can kill anyone anywhere at any time, and I just sort of wonder why they don't do that. But, you know, that's more of an aside than a question.
Yeah, well, I mean, it does beg the question of why you need to destroy basically all of Gaza. You know, I mean, to put a fine point on it, there was this bombing of a school last week, you know, which was horrific, killed 100 Palestinians, a lot of women and children. And the Israeli government's defense was, well, you know, there was something like, I don't know, 12 or 15 Hamas operatives were at this school. Putting aside that you can't even, you know, necessarily verify that, and sometimes those claims have not borne out. One, that's still not legal under international law. Like, you can't just kill, you know, dozens of women and children to kill a few operatives. And you can say Hamas is human shields. That doesn't mean that you can just obliterate all of those innocent civilians as well. But it begs your question, Tommy, of like, it seems like there could have been, you know, a plan to take out Sinwar with the kind of remote detonated device that they seem to have used against Ismail Haniyeh and Iran. That's clearly not the path that they've taken.
Yeah. Anyway, but back to the sort of concerns about this Iranian retaliation. So the worst case scenario that, you know, the U.S. and Israel seem to be preparing for would be a multi-part coordinated operation that includes strikes from Hezbollah, maybe the Houthis from Yemen, and then Iran directly. We don't know yet, though. The Washington Post reported that Israel is considering a preemptive strike against Hezbollah. But, you know, again, they've been hitting Hezbollah targets for months, so I don't really know what that means. On the diplomatic front, you've got the U.S., the U.K., France, and Germany and Italy putting out statements calling for Iran to show restraint. The U.S. has been just sending tons of military assets to the region. They sent a guided missile submarine, which is also very notable that the Pentagon announced that sub's deployment. That doesn't ever happen. They sent a bunch of Navy destroyers. An aircraft carrier is going to the Gulf of Oman. So like very, very serious, you know, military hardware, U.S. military hardware is heading to the region just in case. The new Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, has rejected calls to stand down, calling retaliation a way to stop crime in Iran's legal right. So he's clearly pretty dug in, and this would be his first major decision as president. So I imagine the politics for him are fraught. Ben, you know, the last time Iran launched a major attack on Israel, this extraordinary coordinated effort by the US, the UK, a bunch of regional allies, basically prevented any real damage from happening in Israel. And Biden then was able to tell Netanyahu, stand down, like take the win, do not escalate further. I guess the question now is like, what are the odds that the world gets that lucky a second time? My guess is pretty low.
Yeah, this is not like a game of Russian roulette that you want to keep playing. And look, there's multiple dimensions to this. I mean, the first thing I'd say is that I don't think the Iranian president, you know, obviously won't be the final decision maker. The supreme leader will be. But, you know, the assassination did take place like right after the inauguration of this guy, you know, which is its own timing decision. I mean, obviously, probably the main timing determinant for the Israelis was that Haniyeh was in Iran for this inauguration.
Yeah.
But this was someone who was elected literally wanting to be more moderate, wanting to kind of turn the page to some more engagement with the U.S. That's pretty much derailed by...
Yeah, good way to prevent that from happening.
Good way to prevent that from happening. I'm not suggesting that was the only motivation here, but it's definitely like an ancillary benefit for Bibi Netanyahu if he doesn't want to see the U.S. and Iran engage in any kind of dialogue. That's one thing. Then in terms of what the response could be, I mean, honestly, the Iranians, I know why they do it, but coming out and announcing that you're going to strike is, you know, puts you out on a limb where you feel like you have to do something. There's a lot of different things they could do. They could launch a bunch of things at Israel that could be shot down again like they did last time. I think that, you know, they'd probably lose face if they did that. I would prefer they did nothing. Obviously, I'd prefer that none of this war was going on. So let's just say that. You're right that like then there's the kind of response where there could be waves of attacks from Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, who clearly would want to be part of any action, other Iranian proxies across the region. I think one of the reasons why there's all that U.S. military moving to the region is they could attack our people in places like
Iraq. That's been happening again. Yeah. I mean, a bunch of U.S. troops were hurt in a drone strike, I think, over the weekend.
Yeah. So that's another thing that could happen. Now, another way that the Iranians could do this is they could not announce something, not launch missiles, but like a terrorist attack inside of Israel or something. You know, in the past, that's sometimes how they responded to these things is a few weeks go by and then all of a sudden there's an attack, like a more conventional, well, not that it's conventional, but a terrorist attack. We'll see if they take that road. But anything they do, you know, continues the cycle of escalation. The Israelis do something in return. The thing about preempting Hezbollah that was worrying is that there are some people in the Israeli government, including those far-right ministers and some of the security types, that have talked about invading southern Lebanon and trying to create a buffer in southern Lebanon so that people in Israel can move back to northern Israel. Now, that has some bad echoes of the 80s, if people want to look that up. Israeli invasions of Lebanon are usually not quick or simple or
disastrous.
Yeah. Disastrous, right? And would surely prompt Hezbollah to respond in kind and, you know, further escalate the war in Lebanon. So basically none of this is good. I will say too, Tommy, that like on both, and we could talk about the ceasefire here, but like the U.S. wants a ceasefire and they don't want escalation, but we continue to give totally unconditional military assistance to Israel. I think just authorized another $20 billion in arms sales, waived any concerns about human rights abuses by certain Israeli units that would have been consistent with enforcing U.S. law, move all this military hardware to the region. So if you're Bibi Netanyahu, you know, you may read, you know, in Axios background quotes that, you know, Joe Biden's really pissed at Bibi Netanyahu, but what you see is completely unfettered military equipment coming your way, giant, you know, armada of U.S. military vessels coming to the region. You know, this doesn't feel like exerting leverage for de-escalation. It feels like asserting leverage to give BB blank check.
Yeah, I mean, if you're at the bar by yourself and get into an altercation, you're probably a lot less likely to keep fighting than if you have a 6'8 NFL offensive lineman behind you who keeps handing you guns. You know,
yeah,
I mean, like
exactly.
That's sort of like what's happening here. By the way, three senior Iranian officials told Reuters that they will only hold off on retaliating against Israel if Israel and Hamas agree to a ceasefire deal, which, you know, I imagine some people read that and they feel cynical about it. But again, like, what if we tested the proposition? Because you got the Iranians, the Houthis, Hezbollah, they all say that they are targeting Israel because they want the war in Gaza to end. Now, maybe they're bad people. Maybe they are liars. Maybe the Houthis have decided, wow, we have this capability now where we can just like screw with ships in the Gulf and mess up the global economy and get a bunch of governments to freak out. But like, I don't know. Why don't we try ending the war and calling their bluff? That's what I'd love to see.
Yeah, well, it's always been the case that the only true pathway to de-escalation, you know, because we keep seeing these warnings and these statements and these calls, and that's all good. And certainly it's good and important that, you know, you want to shoot down things that are fired indiscriminately at civilians in Israel. We should do all that. But if there's not an end to the war in Gaza, this is just going to keep happening. And to the Russian roulette point, one of these times, it's not going to, I mean, not that it's ended well already. It hasn't. It's been catastrophic already. But one of these times, it's going to get worse. And one of these times, you could have a full-blown war in Lebanon or a full-blown war between Israel and Iran. And, you know, nothing that we've seen from Netanyahu suggests that he's truly committed to seeing true de-escalation, which would involve a ceasefire in Gaza.
Yeah, you can imagine a very cynical read on Netanyahu where he would love another larger, more open-ended war that would ensure he stays in power. A few more things from Gaza, Ben. So you mentioned this horrible Israeli strike on a school in Gaza City this past Saturday. The White House issued a statement on that attack saying that Israel, quote, must take measures to minimize civilian harm and that, quote, far too many civilians continue to be killed and wounded. Vice President Kamala Harris was out on the campaign trail. She was also asked about the Israeli strike. Here's what she had to say.
You know, yet again, there are far too many civilians who have been killed. I mean, Israel has a right to go after the terrorists that are Hamas. But as I have said many, many times, they also have, I believe, an important responsibility to avoid civilian casualties.
So a few more things out of Gaza I want to get to in a minute, but let's just pause to talk about the vice president's comments for a second, because we're starting to see happen to her what was happening to Biden, which is events are getting interrupted by Gaza protesters more often. There's an open question still, I think, about what the uncommitted movement voters will do at the Democratic convention. People suspect that encampments are about to return to college campuses when kids get back in the fall. You and I have both talked with people in activist groups who are trying to figure out, like, okay, we want this war to end. How do we recalibrate our tactics now that Kamala Harris is the nominee and not Joe Biden? And I figured we could just sort of like talk through our take on all of that, because we are obviously people that have been very critical of Joe Biden's policy with respect to Gaza, want this war to end, and, you know, I think just want to be, like, constructive here. So, I can kick us off. I do think, like, my operating assumption, and I'd love to know if you disagree, Ben, is that while Biden has decided not to run for re-election, I don't think he's going to give up any governing responsibilities, especially not foreign policy, not this issue where he's invested a lot of time and attention, but also Joe Biden just genuinely thinks that he is the smartest guy in the room on foreign policy and the smartest guy in the room when it comes to Bibi Netanyahu, full stop. So, like, that's just a way of saying, I don't think Kamala Harris has any space to really change the administration's policy between now and election day. That said, I do think she has a moral, humanitarian, and political imperative to signal that she would do things differently. And then, you know, bigger picture, just for like activists who are listening or really care about this issue, I just want to repeat that the worst possible thing that could happen for the people in Gaza is Donald Trump getting elected, because he could care less if this war continues or escalates or de-escalates. And also remember that, like, the platform adapted at the Republican National Committee says that Trump would deport, quote unquote, pro-Hamas radicals and make our college campuses safe and patriotic again. So if you're an American protester, Donald Trump wants to deport you, not just not listen to you. So long story short, like, do I think interrupting Kamala Harris's events is going to make her policy change or impact what Joe Biden's are doing? No, I don't at all. And you can tell, like, in how Harris is responding tonally that she doesn't either. Here's one more clip, and then I'll throw over to you.
I'm here because we believe in democracy. Everyone's voice matters, but I am speaking now. I am speaking now. You know what? If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that, otherwise I'm speaking.
So that was Kamala Harris shutting down some Gaza protesters at a recent campaign event. You can tell she sort of, the message has shifted from, I'm listening, I care about all these voices, like I'm, what you do matters, to kind of shut up and sit down for the moment. Like, we got to win this election. Ben, I'm curious what you make of the kind of evolution of her responses on these set of issues, and what you think, you know, if you were like advising an activist group, what is the best way to advocate to end this war in this new context with Harris at the top of the ticket?
Yeah, I think it's like, I'd frame this as a two-way street. So first of all, on the activist side, you do have to, you know, and look, we should just preface this by saying, like, I understand, and you and I both know a bunch of people in this movement. A lot of these are people who've lost like dozens of family members, you know? So it's not the same thing as people, you know, a typical interest group, you know, there are people with understandable passion. The question is, what is the best way to kind of make some headway on the things you care about? And so from the activist perspective, you have to recognize that a couple of things have changed. One, Joe Biden, the man who is truly responsible for the policy that you don't like, is no longer the candidate. And so just kind of transitioning and projecting onto her, I know she's vice president, but nobody thinks she's been the decision maker on Gaza. No. Just projecting onto her the same kind of anger that you had at Joe Biden, I don't think makes sense. Just tactically, just for pure political tactics, it's a changed reality, you know? And the second piece of that is the kind of broad multiracial coalition, dare I say, like the kind of Obama coalition, you know, younger people, people of color, they're super excited about Kamala Harris, and they want to be excited about Kamala Harris. And a lot of those people are people that might even be your natural allies, but they don't want to see Kamala Harris at this critical moment with less than 90 days left, you know, put in difficult circumstances at rallies and things like that. And you just have to kind of contend with that reality too. Mm-hmm. And so then the question is, like, what are you trying to influence here? Because you're right, she's unlikely to be able to kind of go back from a rally and go into the Situation Room and change the policy. You want her to, number one, sit down with and meet with and listen to people in your movement, which is something that Joe Biden did not do, really. I mean, there were kind of a couple of heavily curated meetings at the White House. But I mean, sitting down with people in places like Michigan, places like Georgia, and truly listening to them and hearing their stories and what happened to those families, you should be pushing for that. You should be going in there with like a whole range of things that you'd like to see going forward, you know, post-November. What would you like to see her focus on? Whether it's restrictions of offensive military assistance to Israel, whether it's enforcing U.S. law and international law related to, you know, cutting off assistance to certain units that are, you know, proven, demonstrated to have engaged in potential war crimes, whether it's, what does a massive aid package look like for Gaza? And what does a much more assertive effort look like to get aid into Gaza? There's a whole personnel, like kinds of people you'd like to see working on this policy in a Harris administration. There's a whole agenda of things. And I know it's really hard when you're in the moment here and you're like, I'm worried about what's happening in Gaza today and tomorrow, to look even 3 months ahead. But I think that there's really an opening for the movement, the uncommitted movement, to kind of channel that energy in that kind of direction. On the Harris campaign side, I'd say the same thing. You can't just say, well, now you got to get with the program, it's Kamala. She should be sitting down and listening to those people. We played the clip last week, Tommy, of Tim Walz saying that after the uncommitted movement in Minnesota, that these people's voices should be heard. Walz should be meeting with them as well. Show that there's an open door. Show that you're willing to have hard conversations. Show that you're willing to listen to people. It's going to be hard for them to kind of make promises in those meetings, because let's face it, then they get leaked out and then everybody's arguing about it. Like, but just you know, present ideas, listen, and also have a change of tone. And she's had a change of tone to an extent of saying, I will not be silent. You hear her frustration sounds a little bit more acute than Biden's when she talks about civilian casualties, but taking a different tone. You can't take a different policy when you're vice president, but you can set a different tone in how you talk about the issue, talk about the values and principles that are going to guide you. So I think there's an opportunity here for both sides of this debate in our big tent coalition to come together. I hope both sides take it, because the risk for the activist is that there's this kind of wave of enthusiasm for Kamala Harris, and they start to turn off even some of their allies if they are seen as kind of trying to disrupt that and derail her. On the other hand, for Kamala Harris, politically, let's just talk for, you know, obviously the moral and humanitarian considerations are paramount, but politically, the last thing you want when you do have all those good vibes going in the fall is, yes, like huge protests on campuses that are now directed at you, a sense that you're not listening, Jill Stein and third-party candidates like mucking around in your coalition and peeling
Jill
voters.
Stein, yeah. The most cynical person in the world, saying that she's going to recruit a Palestinian vice presidential nominee, and just like again, just a clear effort to try to herd the Democratic ticket.
Yeah.
It's nothing more.
So like, I hope that we can find a way to kind of, we're not going to bridge this distance fully, but at least narrow that distance and kind of create some lines of communication.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I'm not telling anyone not to protest or not to be an activist in the way they see fit.
I'm
just do think, like, I think we should all be adults here and try to think through what is effective and what is not. And I think Joe Biden felt immovable on this issue. Kamala Harris does not at all. I think she starts in a better place and will get to a better place. But I think we have to be honest with ourselves about the amount of power she has in this moment. And unfortunately, it is limited. Two quick things before we go to break. It has been a little over 2 years since the Dobbs decision overturned Roe versus Wade, removing the constitutional right to abortion. And the country is still reeling from this decision to take the country back 50 years. But for an entire movement of high-ranking Republican officials, Dobbs is just the beginning. On this week's Strict Scrutiny, Kate, Melissa, and Leah look back on that fateful 2022 decision and how it rocked the reproductive world since. They're also going to dig into how severe abortion restrictions tie into the horrifying plans of Project 2025. To learn more about the repercussions of this decision and follow all the news that's fit to scream about, look for the episode titled State of the Uterus on Strict Scrutiny's feed. Also, next week, we are going to be at the Democratic National Convention. Here at Crooked Media, we're going to try to give Friends of the Pod subscribers access to a lot of behind-the-scenes content and community events, including a DNC subscriber live chat, a new subscriber-exclusive segment featuring all of us hanging out back-to-back, and then 4 ad-free episodes of Pod Save America recapping the biggest convention news of the night and brand new episodes of Inside 2024 and Polar Coaster from Dan Pfeiffer. So it's going to be a hell of a week. And, you know, we got a Democratic Party nominee, so it'll be a good deal. Get all of our exclusive DNC content and more when you subscribe to Friends of the Pod. Go to crooked.com/friends to sign up now.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking 3 questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Work moves fast. From emails and reports to proposals and updates, you're expected to think clearly, write confidently, and get it right the first time. And every message counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It gives you everything you need to think, write, and finish in one place. Or anywhere you type and text. You'll never have to switch tools or tabs. Grammarly's AI agents are built for how you work and where you work, so you can find the right words, adjust your tone, and predict how your message might land before you hit send. Your ideas will get a boost, while still sounding natural, credible, and just the way you want. For nearly 17 years, Grammarly has been the standard for responsible AI. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at Grammarly.com. That's Grammarly.com.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Just a couple more updates on just the situation in Gaza, and then we'll come back around to the ceasefire thing, because I think that's relevant too for this political conversation we're having. So in Gaza, again, tens of thousands of people were ordered to move from a designated humanitarian zone in Khan Yunis after Israel said that Hamas had fired rockets from the area. But again, these are people that have been moved over and over and over again as Gaza has just been unlivable. So hell on earth for these people. The Wall Street Journal had a long feature about how aid isn't getting into Gaza once again. Since the IDF operation Rafah in May, aid going to Gaza has decreased, subjecting almost everyone in Gaza to food insecurity and resulting in dozens of deaths from malnutrition. According to the UN, the number of aid trucks has more than halved to less than 80 a day in June and July. And then politically in Israel, we're seeing more cracks in Netanyahu's government. There's this growing rift between Bibi Netanyahu and his defense minister, Yoav Gallant. That continues to grow and become more public. This time, Gallant reportedly called Bibi's aim of total victory over Hamas, quote unquote, nonsense in a closed door meeting with the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee. Netanyahu's office fired back in the press, saying that Gallant adopts the anti-Israel narrative and that he harms the chances of reaching a hostage release deal. So again, these guys are in the same political party, but Gallant has become this sort of voice of moderation in this very extreme government. And those voices keep getting drowned out by more extreme factions. And then finally, right before we started recording, there was a report in the New York Times that said Israel has been repeatedly adding new conditions to ceasefire proposals that they had already put forward, including like very sensitive issues like demanding that Israel retain control of Gaza's southern border or not allowing displaced Palestinians to return to their homes in northern Gaza. So again, Ben, this just sort of like gets us back to this activism question where clearly Bibi Netanyahu does not want to cut this ceasefire deal. Like he is doing everything he can to throw up roadblocks in front of his own negotiators at times to prevent it from happening. So I do think we should keep the pressure on the Biden administration to, you know, cut off weapons and stop sending arms and like fueling this war. But, you know, there just feels like there's no light at the end of the tunnel right now because we just have a bad faith actor in Bibi Netanyahu and a terrorist organization in Hamas, and getting them to a ceasefire is just impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's depressing about this is that the Biden administration, after that kind of one weapons shipment was paused in the spring, and there was a backlash to that, they seem to have no appetite to entertain that again, which I think is a tragic mistake, you know. And so the play that they ran was, remember Biden going out and announcing that there was an Israeli proposal that everybody had agreed to, and now it was all on Hamas. I have no doubt that Hamas is, you know, Sinwar is the leader of Hamas. I'm no doubt they're a gigantic fucking problem in the negotiations. It's also the case, clearly, and this report confirms, this is not an Israeli proposal. I mean, maybe some Israeli negotiator agreed to it, but if Bibi Netanyahu continually introduces new conditions and blows things up at the end, how can you say it's an Israeli proposal when the Israeli prime minister doesn't agree to it? And you know, that's been staring us in the face for weeks now, that he's just playing for time and playing a blame game, just trying to, you know, shift the blame on Hamas, and even better if it's the Americans that are doing that. And to me, the reality is, look, if they can somehow pull a rabbit out of a hat and get a negotiated ceasefire, that's by far the first best option. It does not look pretty likely right now, though, Tommy. And the question is, if you want a ceasefire because you think it's the best way to de-escalate, get aid in, and frankly, continue to negotiate for the hostages, then the ceasefire itself has to be the objective of U.S. policy. And that only involves using some leverage to get the Israeli government into a ceasefire. And that involves things like weapons, you know? And so if we're not willing to entertain using leverage, we're going to be kind of stuck in this status quo where you're hoping that the diplomats can somehow overcome the fact that Sinwar and Netanyahu are the final decision makers here. And that's asking a lot of diplomats.
Yeah, it really, really is. One more sort of piece of interesting news here about how foreign affairs is directly overlapping with our elections. Last Friday, Microsoft announced that a high-ranking official from a presidential campaign had their email hacked through a phishing scheme. That's sort of, you know, when you get one of those emails, it's like, click this link and you end up, you know, giving away your password somehow or getting some malware on your computer. This hack reportedly came from a unit run by Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Since then, the Trump campaign has confirmed that they were the target of this hack. And then the Washington Post broke the news that Roger Stone was the victim. For those who don't know who Roger Stone is, he's like he calls himself a dirty trickster. He's actually way worse than that. He's like a scumbag who worked for Richard Nixon. He was,
Reagan. He was a quote unquote rat fucker for Ronald Reagan. Back
in the day. He worked for all the kind of worst right wing racist, Republican operatives over the years and has been a Trump buddy for a long time. So Politico, the Washington Post, and the New York Times have said they've been getting emails from an anonymous source with internal documents from the Trump campaign that included communications about the VP pick before it was public, like apparently like even a preliminary vetting document on J.D. Vance. That said, none of these outlets have published any of these hacked documents. The Harris campaign was also targeted by these phishing attempts, and now the FBI is investigating the whole thing. I'm sure our listeners remember the time when the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's aide, John Podesta, were hacked back in 2016, and there was just a ton of coverage of those materials.
Near attendant emails reprinted in the New York Times.
Months and months worth of coverage. Yeah. Also, at the time, Trump was literally begging Russia to hack Hillary's emails. He was also saying things like, quote, I love WikiLeaks. And now, without irony, his spokesman says, quote, any media or news outlet reprinting documents or internal communications are doing the bidding of America's enemies and doing exactly what they want. Ben,
I thought it was a hoax,
Yeah, I thought it was a hoax too. Ben, here's my question. The IRGC they're bad guys, but they're pretty smart. Why are they trying to launder hacked materials through Politico? Like, isn't the election interference playbook that you just buy a URL and throw them on there, like hand them over to WikiLeaks, whatever? What are we doing here?
Yeah. The playbook would be to dump them out. I mean, the reality is that, you know, Russia, China, and Iran all are engaged in election interference of one sort or another. Plenty of reporting on this. They try hacking, hack and publish, hack and release, and obviously a lot of misinformation and disinformation. In terms of the Iranian motivation, there's two potential motivations here. One is sometimes it's just sowing chaos, right? And showing your, flexing your muscles, showing that we can reach into your system. And so the reason that if it was Iranians, they might go after both campaigns is that it's not even really about helping one candidate or another. It's just about chaos and showing, how capable Iran is. The other is they do have their own beef with Trump. It's the IRGC in particular that has never forgiven him and won't for the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. So they may have a particular motivation to try to embarrass Trump himself. But some of this is also just like, hey, like maybe we all learned after John Podesta clicked on a suspicious looking link in 2016, Roger Stone's email hygiene, probably not that great, some of the responsibility has migrated onto the people who have to kind of defend these systems here. And that guy's the kind of guy that probably has like an AOL account and is computer literacy halted around, the early aughts, I think,
Yeah, I think Roger Stone sort of infamously was caught, advertising on some swinger websites. I know there was a New Yorker profile of him in 2008 by Jeffrey Toobin, actually.
Second appearance by Toobin.
Where Roger Stone had Jeff meet him at the leading swingers club in Miami for their conversation about what role that Stone had played in the downfall of Elliot Spitzer. So I don't know. Everything's just really weird.
Yeah, it's not like Roger Stone's never tried to steal proprietary information and make use of it. Not saying it's okay. It's not okay. But I think what people,
fan.
yeah, people should just be ready for the fact that there's going to be a bunch of efforts at election interference. And one of the things that's happened that's good, I think, in our electorate is by the third Trump election, like, you know, I think not all people, but more people are a little bit more mindful to, you know, not trust everything they see online and to kind of wonder about the origins of stuff. And if you're working on a campaign, like we got hacked by the Chinese in 2008. Maybe some people aren't old enough to know that, but like, you know, this not, it's even 2016 wasn't the first time a foreign government hacked a campaign.
Happy yeah. I hate the fact that Hillary Clinton got completely screwed by a hacked material, hack and dump released by WikiLeaks and others. And that Trump seems to be getting away with it. That said, I also kind of think that major news outlets showing some restraint around hack materials is maybe a good thing or a good thing, a rule going forward. I still don't know how you prevent this stuff from happening because, again, it's the internet. You can just dump it online, but...
That's exactly the right point. It's like, you're never going to prevent this. But what you can do is have better antibodies against it, better cyber defenses, better public information about, you know, information potentially come from state-sponsored sources. And yeah, a media that is more responsible and isn't going to spend weeks publishing, you know, as much as I'd like to see Roger Stone's email, I don't need to see his fucking email to know he's an asshole. So like, you know, Politico made well the right said. Call, you know?
Yeah, well said. A couple more things before we get to your interview. So it's been 2 weeks since the presidential election to Venezuela. As we've discussed, all available information suggests that despite President Maduro's many efforts to rig the election, prevent any real opposition from running, he still lost in a landslide. I saw some estimates that he lost by up to 38 points. So Maduro got smoked in this election. But of course, instead of giving up power, Maduro has unleashed a brutal crackdown on opposition leaders and protesters and anybody that opposes him. Local NGOs say around 1,200 people have been detained, some even on terrorism charges, and up to 24 have been killed. So it's been very, very ugly in Venezuela. The Wall Street Journal, Maduro even promised to build two new prisons to house all the political prisoners that will come from this. So he's not hiding this. Now, Ben, this is where it gets interesting. The Wall Street Journal reported that the U.S. has discussed giving Maduro and his top lieutenants pardons if they will agree to give up power, so like an amnesty deal. So Maduro has been indicted for drug trafficking and conspiracies and all sorts of crimes. The State Department denied this Wall Street Journal report saying, we have not made any efforts to Maduro or others since this election. Interesting sort of caveat there. Ben, I just wondered what you made of these reports. I mean, obviously giving Maduro amnesty in the wake of all that he's done would be very difficult politics. But just stepping back, like I personally think getting rid of this guy in exchange not prosecuting him is a great deal for the people of Venezuela.
Yeah.
That said, like, I don't know. I can't imagine the U.S. offering this to him because there's no way he's going to take it unless they've also kind of like figured out some nice villa for him to live in Saudi Arabia or something. But I don't know. What did you make of this?
Yeah. So I think that, first of all, the scale of the defeat kind of matters. He's pretty humiliated. And where it matters is not just internationally, but I think like the Venezuelan military, which he's relied on, you know, they kind of know they're sitting on this powder keg. They're propping up this guy that can't survive without him, who's deeply unpopular. And, you know, the whole thing could blow for them at some point. And so I think he's weakened internally. And the opposition has proven resilient and pretty fucking brave. Like they're still going out, they're still protesting. You also get these reports that Mexico, Brazil, and Colombia are also getting involved behind the scenes to try to negotiate something between the opposition and Maduro. That's positive, too, because those are three leftist leaders, right? all of those are people that in the past, you know, maybe haven't been pro-Maduro, but they've certainly, you know, they're not in the kind of right-wing milieu of Latin America. If this guy and his kind of core lieutenants can get some beachfront property in Brazil and just be done with it, like that is far and away best outcome. I would much rather see a new government, a transitional government in Venezuela, an end to this nightmare. And, you know, if the price of that is, you know, Maduro is not behind bars, he's, you know, on some compound somewhere in Cuba or Brazil or wherever. Like, let's try everything we can do to get that to be the outcome. Because the goal here is ultimately making life better for Venezuelans and ending this humanitarian and political crisis. So I think the administration is right. I think they've handled this well and to be creative and to try to, you know, be open to different solutions, and also to kind of let some of those left-wing Latin American governments pursue some of this negotiations on their own. They don't bring the same baggage that America does either.
Yeah, I love to take the lead. I like that Maduro is like trying to get Twitter banned for 10 days and then tell Venezuelans to uninstall WhatsApp as a way of like stopping the protests. I don't know that that one's going to work, buddy.
No, sorry, buddy.
A couple more quick things. So there was some scary news out of Austria last week for Taylor Swift fans and really anyone who wants to live in a world where it's safe to be a normal human being and go to concerts. So Taylor was supposed to perform 3 shows in Vienna. She had to cancel them all because of a planned terrorist attack that was luckily unraveled. The U.S. passed along intelligence to Austrian officials that led to the arrest of 3 teenagers. When the cops searched the home of the oldest one, they found explosive devices, detonators, ISIS propaganda material, nearly $23,000 in counterfeit money, machetes, knives, and anabolic steroids. That last one was a swerve, but Andrew Tate, exactly. But, you know, so the authorities thought they were radicalized online by ISIS-K, but that radicalization turned into a very serious, scary plot. 65,000 people were expected to be in the audience at the concerts each night, along with tens of thousands of others. So like, you know, we don't have to spell out how bad this could have been. ISIS has a track record of targeting music venues. There was the Bataclan theater attack in Paris in 2015. There was a suicide bombing at Ariana Grande's show in England back in 2017. The Swifties who traveled to Vienna for the show were understandably scared and heartbroken, but many still gathered in the streets to just sing her songs and be together. Here's a clip. So a couple things, Ben. Shout out to the U.S. intelligence community for disrupting this one. Pretty good work there. Second, very weird and awful that this was the second Taylor Swift connected like violent incident in a couple weeks. There was the stabbing at a Taylor Swift themed children's dance class in the UK that killed, you know, small girls and led to these horrible riots I know you guys talked about last week. And then finally, it's just worth noting that Taylor Swift in 2019 wrote a piece where she talked about how after the Manchester bombing at the Ariana Grande concert and the Las Vegas shooting, she was scared to go back out on tour because she felt like, I don't know how I can keep my audience safe given all that's happening around the world. And obviously, like, she's done all they can. They have security sweeps. You know, you go through like essentially metal detectors when you go to a lot of concerts these days. But the reality is that in a world with ISIS telling people to target, like, you know, quote unquote, soft targets like concerts, or in the US where we refuse to do anything about guns being on the streets, even bump stocks, which is the device that was used to make the Las Vegas shooting so horrific, artists just can't fully protect their fans. And that is an awful feeling for someone like Taylor Swift when you know that, like, you're the reason these people are coming together and you might also be the reason they're at risk.
Yeah, I mean, this was a scary one, you know, and I think one of the questions that, you know, the intelligence community is probably trying to answer is, was this kind of ISIS kind of leadership and strategists plotting this in a way that they might try to pursue somewhere else? Or was this kind of a handful of self-radicalized teenagers motivated by ISIS ideology? You know, it matters just because you want to understand whether this was a kind of isolated, unique threat or whether ISIS has some, you know, bullseye on Taylor Swift concerts. The problem is once this gets out, though, in some ways, then you're worried about copycats doing it someplace else. It's scary. Let's face it, it's scary. I mean, what you can do is you can have really, really tight security at these concerts. I mean, that's really all you can do, and ask fans to put up with a fair amount of inconvenience to try to stop these types of people from getting anywhere near a concert venue. But you cannot totally eliminate risk. I did love the response from those like Swifties because like pretty giant fuck you to ISIS, you know, like the haters gonna hate, you know, like there's a joy to Taylor Swift that you hate to see being corrupted by all these creeps, you know. I mean, you mentioned that my daughter was in Taylor Swift camp last week, and so, you know, which sounded not that unlike what, you know, that crime in the UK was, you know, where it took place. But I mean, you can't eliminate risk. I hope that, though, that doesn't mean that people, you know, she doesn't keep putting on concerts and that people stop going to concerts. I mean, let's, you know, I hate to be that person who uses odds, but it is true that if you consider the millions and millions of people who've safely seen Taylor Swift the last couple of years, this is by and large a safe thing to do. But, you know, this is a reminder that, you know, there's fucked up people in the world who try to do fucked up things.
Yeah, there certainly are. But also, if you lined up, you know, all the Taylor Swift fans on one side of like an old school battlefield, we're thinking, you know, Braveheart style,
yeah,
versus all of ISIS. ISIS is cooked.
No, it's cooked. I mean, that's
they're going to smoke their ass.
I got to say too, good. You know, Jake Sullivan was on last week. He said that the daughter of one of the journalists who was returned in the exchange missed a Taylor Swift concert in Warsaw, and could anybody help her get tickets? We heard from some worldos. Really appreciate that. Couple plugged in people too, though, who pointed out that actually the problem is the Vienna one would have been the natural because that was what's next. So we're still looking for that ticket, but what we really care about is people being safe. So at least they caught this one in time.
Yeah, great work to everyone who was part of that law enforcement operation. Finally, Ben, I just want to end with a question, which is, hasn't Pompeii been through enough from being buried under layers of volcanic ash to managing hordes of tourists? You know, Pompeii, it's gotten a raw deal. And the latest indignity is the prospect of Madonna renting a Pompeii amphitheater for her 66th birthday party. This is from the always factual, never wrong Daily Mail, who reported that the Queen of Pop planned to invite 500 of her closest friends, including Katy Perry, to the ruins to celebrate. Rentals of this particular space, the Teatro Grande, cost just 30,000 euros. I expected more. That is that could barely get you a decent bat mitzvah space here in Los Angeles.
It's like a cheap wedding in LA, yeah.
Yeah, not that I'm already stressing out about this stuff with a two-year-old, not even two-year-old. So not surprisingly, though, I guess some Italians were pissed about these reports. One official complained about the price tag being too low, say it was like giving Pompeii away. As of this recording, it does seem like Madonna has made alternative arrangements for her special day. There she might just be somewhere else with no party. Part of me understands why they were pissed, but also I feel like this is now a standard thing. Like a couple weeks ago, we just talked about a wedding at the Great Pyramid of Giza. I feel like you can just kind of rent out some wacky venues these days.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like there's probably 100 of these things that happen and nobody pays any attention to it. And then it's just like, what is the one that gets in the Daily Mail and everybody gets like, pissed off about it?
You know? Exactly.
Because I think that's pretty much what's happening here. I don't know if there's, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Madonna had her beefs with the Catholic Church. So I don't know if that like rubbed them.
What was her beef?
The she didn't have her beef. The Catholic Church had a beef with her. I'm a Madonna person. Like before I was a Swiftie, I was into Madonna.
Oh, yeah, because the Like a Prayer video, yeah, that made sense. Yeah. In my head, I was thinking of Sinead O'Connor ripping up the photo of the Pope.
No, it was nothing like that.
How dare she?
It was a little more tame.
You know who was right here? Sinead O'Connor.
Well, I mean, her name is Madonna, let's face it. And, you know, that, like, yeah, the, Like a Prayer and all that.
Basics.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like maybe just raise the price tag. Get something out of it. Like fix up Pompeii a little, you know?
Okay, enough about Pompeii. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, you'll hear Ben's interview with Sahar Halimzai about what life is like for women and girls in Afghanistan 3 years after the fall of Kabul. So stick around for that.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Work moves fast. From emails and reports to proposals and updates, you're expected to think clearly, write confidently, and get it right the first time. And every message counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It gives you everything you need to think, write, and finish in one place. Or anywhere you type and text. You'll never have to switch tools or tabs. Grammarly's AI agents are built for how you work and where you work, so you can find the right words, adjust your tone, and predict how your message might land before you hit send. Your ideas will get a boost, while still sounding natural, credible, and just the way you want. For nearly 17 years, Grammarly has been the standard for responsible AI. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at Grammarly.com. That's Grammarly.com.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action, not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Okay, so this month marks 3 years since the calamitous U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the takeover by the Taliban. Since then, life has changed dramatically in the country, especially for women and girls. I'm very pleased to be welcoming back to Pod Save the World Sahar Halamzai, who's the director of the Afghanistan Initiative at the Malala Fund. Sahar, so good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me back on, Ben.
So let's just start by giving our listeners a sense of how things have changed, particularly for women and girls in the last 3 years. What is life like for girls under the Taliban, and how have those how has that changed in the last 3 years?
Thank you so much. I think every Afghan will remember the moment the Taliban entered Kabul on August 15, 3 years ago. And since that day, they have released a steady stream of decrees that have impacted every aspect of girls and women's rights. Specifically, girls aren't allowed to go to school past grade six. Women can't take a stroll in the park. They can't go get a haircut. They can't access a doctor. They have no freedom of movement. It is what many scholars, legal experts, human rights activists around the world are calling a system of gender apartheid. Life is unrecognizable for girls and women in Afghanistan today.
And basically, I mean, it's impossible to go to school, right? If you are a 12-year-old girl in Afghanistan, what kind of future does the Taliban want you to have when it comes to school and work and your ability to make your own choices about, you know, who you marry and how you have kids and how you live?
The Taliban don't want you to have any choice, any agency. Once you age out from grade six, so 12 years onwards, you really have very few options other than to remain at home. Malala Fund has been investing for the last 3 years in partners inside and outside Afghanistan who are providing alternative pathways to education, and we're doing everything that we can. But essentially, nothing can make up for what girls are losing out on. Peer support, being able to make decisions about what they learn, their future, they are fully being erased from public life.
And, you know, you're in contact with people in Afghanistan. What is the kind of mental health picture for women and girls? I mean, to go from, you know, the relative openness of the last, you know, preceding 20 years to this system of apartheid, which we'll talk about in a second. What are you hearing from women and girls in Afghanistan about what this is doing to their mental health?
I think there is just deep despair across the country. I think for any of us who take so many of our basic freedoms for granted, being able to walk to the shop or go to the park or meet your friends, having that being taken away from you overnight is hugely, it's a shock to the system. So I think a lot of the people that I talk to every day are still processing the reality that they find themselves in. And I think in particular, what is a huge part of this tragedy for a lot of these girls and women is that none of this was inevitable. You know, it didn't have to happen this way. It was entirely man-made. The US struck a deal with the Taliban in 2020. They sidelined the then Afghan government. They sidelined the Afghan people and ignored repeated red flags and calls by girls and women and activists and allies that said, Taliban 2.0 is not going to emerge. They are not going to change. They will not be different. And here we are today, 3 years later, and it's just a huge, huge humanitarian crisis, one of the world's worst mental health crises. We're hearing stories of girls who are committing suicide in some of the most horrific ways possible. We're hearing about egregious abuses of girls who are protesting on the streets. It is, the situation is extreme and dire.
So you're working with Malala on this concept of gender apartheid, which you referenced earlier, which is an effort to essentially work through the UN system to kind of codify gender apartheid as a crime against humanity. Can you just describe like what that effort is? What is the meaning to you of gender apartheid, and how would that enter into a system of international law?
So we've very much taken the lead of Afghan women and the protesters and girls inside the country who are talking about the system they're being forced to live under. And what we mean when we say gender apartheid is this oppression is systemic, it's institutionalized, and it's a core part of the Taliban's governance model. It is their governance model to have men dominate women. That is part of how they rule. And there is, we believe, and we're working with partners around the world, that there is an urgent need to recognize gender apartheid as a crimes against humanity. And we have this incredible opportunity at coming up. The Sixth Committee has been meeting for the last year and a half. That's the UN's legal committee, and really looking at the draft articles of Crimes Against Humanity Treaty. And what we're saying is this is an opportunity for us to add gender apartheid as part of that codification in international law. We believe that that will close the gap that exists in international law. There is currently nothing on the books that allows us to really address the systemic nature of oppression we're seeing in Afghanistan today under Taliban rule. But it also creates rules for states and other agencies and international institutions who are engaging with the Taliban. It creates a parameter that tells us how we should be engaging with a regime like the Taliban.
And so let's say this happened. You know, I know there's a lot more work to be done, mm-hmm. which we can talk about in a second. But what would the consequences be for the Taliban or for governments that deal with the Taliban if this were codified in the UN system, gender apartheid, as a crime against humanity that the Taliban is violating?
I think we would look at what the accountability mechanisms look like, but essentially codifying gender apartheid as part of international law means that we will prevent complicity of states in such crimes. So very much like apartheid South Africa and the movement that was built around dismantling that oppressive system, what we're saying is codifying gender apartheid will create rules for how we engage with a regime like the Taliban. So if our elected representatives choose to sit across the table from a regime that is instituting a system of gender apartheid, then there are lots of different ways that we can hold them accountable.
Well, and for instance, I recently, right, there were some meetings with the Taliban in Doha, and I noticed that, you know, I think Secretary General Gutierrez might have been involved and other governments, and there were no women invited to those meetings. And that was a bit of a backlash to that. I mean, would one of the consequences be that that kind of thing wouldn't happen, that there'd be kind of a higher prioritization on insisting that women's voices are heard in other countries' engagements with Afghanistan?
Absolutely. It would compel states to root their approach in principled engagement, which means prioritizing basic human rights. So part of the negotiations with the Taliban would be there'd be red lines about what those negotiations look like. And there is just this continuation in the way that we have engaged with the Taliban since the Doha negotiations 4 or 5 years ago, where we've conceded to every demand when the Taliban have made it. And actually, this will, codifying gender apartheid, will compel us, will compel our elected representatives and other states who are engaging with them with red lines, so that we make it really clear that when you're engaging with the Taliban, it has to be principled. You have to have women at the table, and you can't negotiate girls and women's rights away.
So where does this currently stand? I mean, there's such a common sense to this. I mean, if apartheid on the basis of race and ethnicity is codified after the South Africa experience, it stands to reason that women are similarly a group of people that are facing apartheid-like conditions. You know, not just in Afghanistan, you know, I think Iran would be a candidate for for this as well. But what countries have signed on to this, and what's your sense of the level of momentum to continue to push this forward in the UN system?
I mean, the momentum is really huge. 2 years ago, nobody was talking about it in the terms that we're talking about it today. We have such an incredible group of member states who are supporting this, who have expressed openness to talk about codifying gender apartheid as part of this UN process. Countries like Mexico, Malta, the Philippines, Austria. We have built a really strong and powerful movement, but we need everybody to support this work. We need everybody to write to their elected representatives, to share these stories of Afghan women and girls, to share their stories of resistance, to talk about the fact that girls aren't allowed to get basic education in Afghanistan. And we're continuously engaging with a regime that is enforcing that. So the momentum is really positive. I really think that it's moving in the right direction, but we need all the help we can get.
So you may have noticed we're having an election here in the United States, and Kamala Harris has captured a lot of excitement, kind of mobilized people that had kind of gotten pretty turned off U.S. politics, kind of rebuilding some of that Obama coalition of younger people, people of color. Women are central to her message because reproductive freedom and abortion have been very mobilizing issues for her here. I'm kind of tossing a softball, Sahar, in the sense of what would you like to see a Kamala Harris do if she's elected on this issue? And frankly, like, what is the U.S., as the U.S. is kind of beginning to be concerned about ISIS and, you know, its reconstitution in parts of Afghanistan, and how would you, you know, what is the U.S.'s responsibility here? What opportunity exists for her? And what would you say to people who say, well, we can't raise issues like this because we have to raise, you know, national security issues like ISIS in our engagement with the Taliban?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I would say is that politicians on both sides of the aisle in the U.S., but also around the world, you know, precipitated the situation we're seeing in Afghanistan today. So I think everybody has a responsibility when it comes to actually shining a light and trying to pull back from the situation we're seeing happen in Afghanistan. But I think beyond that, if we allow a system of gender apartheid as we're seeing happen in Afghanistan today, we're just setting a dangerous precedent when it comes to girls and women's rights everywhere. To me, I always say, if the person that I voted for is comfortable to sit across a table from a regime that is disappearing women from the streets for protesting for their right to education, that is at war with teenage girls, that is stopping women from gaining access to life-saving humanitarian aid, what will they do when they have to fight for my rights? I think that's the question we should all be asking.
Yeah, no, and it's a good opportunity. I mean, the U.S., you know, talked a lot about these issues when we were kind of trying to build public support and justify our continued intervention in Afghanistan. Here's an opportunity to actually, you know, mean what we say about those issues. I wanted to ask you, at the Olympics in Paris, there were several Afghan women there. One in particular, Maniza Talash, who was on the refugee Olympic team, but an Afghan woman, but she represented the refugee Olympic team. was actually disqualified from the Breaker competition for wearing a cape with the words "Free Afghan Women," which I thought was a very powerful moment. Mm. You're a former refugee. What are Afghan women trying to tell us? Did something like that get attention back in Afghanistan, or is there a kind of information blackout that keeps that out? I mean, what does something like that mean to Afghan women?
The vast majority of the resistance and the protests against the Taliban are coming from women and girls inside Afghanistan. From the day the Taliban entered Kabul in August 15, 3 years ago, to this week, Afghan women and girls are protesting on the streets of Afghanistan in the face of huge risk. They're being disappeared. They're being tortured in Taliban prisons. The Taliban are co-opting their male family members and their punitive system. So if you've been arrested for protesting, they will go to your brother or father or husband and say, if these women have been caught protesting again, that you will be punished. So the vast majority of the pushback is coming from women and girls inside Afghanistan. When it comes to the bravery of someone like Manisha Talosh, to me, I think it exemplifies that resistance inside the country. But I also think it's very bittersweet in a way, because it's such a deep loss to Afghanistan as a country and the world, really, that a young woman has to make that really, what I am sure was a difficult decision, to use that moment and to use that platform to make that sacrifice to inform the world about what is happening to her community, to women and girls inside Afghanistan. Women and girls in Afghanistan know what is happening to them. They're fighting it. They're resisting it. They're running underground schools. They're running safe houses. They're protesting on the streets against armed Taliban. The problem is that the world isn't paying as much attention as they should be. So I think that what Manisha did was really to inform us about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say, it's a 3-year anniversary. I mean, in addition to your work with the Malala Fund, I know, like so many people, you were involved in helping a lot of people who wanted to get out of Afghanistan because they feared for themselves. I know that is an ongoing process for a lot of people. There's still people who are stuck in third countries without a permanent home. There are people, obviously, in Afghanistan who are separated from their families. What can people do? You know, if people care about this and want to get involved, is there a way for them to support these efforts, to plug into the Malala Fund, or simply to just have their voices heard on the gender apartheid issue? What would you say to people that want to feel like there's more that they can do about this?
I mean, there's so much people can do. Malala Fund has an incredible portfolio of grantees we support inside and outside Afghanistan. So please go on our website, look at the organizations we support, you know, support them, share these stories of resistance of these Afghan women and girls who are actually doing the incredibly courageous, difficult work of standing up against the Taliban, and really write to your elected representatives, ask them, what are they doing about gender apartheid in Afghanistan? What are they doing about the refugee crisis? You know, so many of the Afghans we're seeing stuck in third countries or making these incredibly perilous, difficult journeys are our former allies, are, you know, Afghans who supported the 20-year international presence. There's so many things that people can do. Please go on our website, go on our social media. We constantly amplify and highlight stories of young women, of organizations inside and outside Afghanistan who are actually taking on this fight.
Well, look, thanks so much for joining us. We'll definitely do that. Encourage people to check out Malala Fund, and also to your other point, just to kind of remain focused on what Afghan women are doing and standing up for their own rights, and Afghans who are still in a perilous limbo in many places. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben.
Thanks again to Sahar for joining the show. Ben, it's good to see you on Zoom next week. Are we together next week? Oh, no. Am I in
your convention, right?
I'm at the DNC next week.
Yeah.
It's like ships passing in the night.
Yeah, no, it's just a crazy summer. We did, you know, Olympics too. The one thing I've got to say, Tommy, is that the Jordan Chiles medal revocation has got my patriotic, you know, blood up a little bit here.
So that one.
We need to keep some long memories here for the court of arbitration and for the Olympics. I kind of don't hold it against the Romanians, but you know, come on, guys, give them both bronzes at least.
Give them that's clearly the solution. Give them both bronzes.
And by the way, Olympics. Let me just vent for 1 second here.
Let's hear
they didn't. They love, you know, putting up the picture of Simone and Jordan like bowing and the sportsmanship and the three black women on the podium and. You know, the Louvre is tweeting, like, put it in the Louvre. So they, like, milked the moment when it was, like, for their purposes. Then they take the medal away from her. Give me a break. Sorry.
You know what's going in the Louvre is the French dick hitting the high jump thing. That's going to go in the Louvre, I think, if we're being honest.
Not a big enough room, you know?
Also, the Australian breakdancer was so, so funny. Have you seen this?
I couldn't unsee it.
How do you avoid it? Yeah,
I couldn't decide how I felt about it because on the one end, I was like, I was kind of siding with her because I was like, who gives a shit? Like, you know, she cares. She likes breakdancing. The Australians are a little weird. She did her kangaroo thing. Now there's a whole scandal that she like rigged the competition to win though, to get in the Olympics.
Really?
So, yeah, it's taking a turn. It's taking like a darker turn. So who knows, you know?
I saw a very funny TikTok that someone said was her, that I assume was her, where she was kind of making fun of the whole thing. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah, I just want to feel good about the Olympics. Who cares? That's my point. I want to feel good about the Olympics. I want, you know, let's all like take the good vibes out of it.
Amen. All right, well, that's it for us. Talk to you guys next week.
See ya.
If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. If you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Alona Minkowski. Our associate producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick and engineered by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Phoebe Bradford, William Jones, Kirill Palaviv, and Molly Lobel, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action. Not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Pepsi Prebiotic Cola, an original and cherry vanilla. That Pepsi taste you love with no artificial sweeteners, only 30 calories, just 5 grams of sugar, and 3 grams of prebiotic fiber. That great Pepsi taste with even more to love. Pepsi Prebiotic Cola. Unbelievably Pepsi.